Good afternoon, everyone. On the clock on the wall says 8:30, so it must be time, almost 8:30, so it must be time to start this Lou Jones program. As announced, this is a program on affidavits of default. The reason for the program is that judges have been talking about this for several months, at least since Judge Perhatch came on board. And we realize that this is an area in which there is disuniformity on how we handle things, which is probably not a good thing for us or, more importantly, you. So as probably everybody looking around the room, everybody in this room realizes what I'm talking about by the lingo. But just to be clear, these are affidavits of default on doomsday orders. Doomsday orders, of course, are orders that resolve a motion, typically denying it, and usually it's a motion to dismiss by a Chapter 13 trustee or a motion for relief from the stay, and the relief that is sought in the motion is denied in the order contingent upon the non-moving party, most typically the debtor, performing certain things out into the future for some period, typically 6 months, typically making plan payments that are called for or making regular mortgage payments to a secured creditor. If the condition the order provides is unrealized, then the relief that the original motion sought is afforded to the moving party upon the presentation of evidence to the court that the condition has been satisfied. That evidence typically, historically, has been in terms of an affidavit, hence the term affidavit of default. Although, going back to Tom King, his office filed certificates of default, and Trustee Garcia still does that. I think maybe the trustees are moving towards certificates of default. In any event, a certificate of default by a lawyer, backed up by the 9011 obligations, like an affidavit of default, which is sworn, or an unsworn declaration under 28 U.S.C. 1746, all of these have the backstop that there is, that purports to be true. So that sort of is how things typically have progressed, and there's general uniformity about that, although some of us required certain things to be in the doomsday orders and others of us didn't. Where things really started to get sort of less uniform is what happens once there is an affidavit of default, and I'll just use affidavit of default to pick up all of those types of evidence. Affidavit of default filed. And oftentimes, the affidavit is met with an objection. Now, the objection historically has really sort of been treated as if the affidavit of default is a moving paper, and then there's an objection to it. And that led sometimes by self-scheduling by the lawyers, other times by the court, to a hearing on the affidavit of default. Rather than, as I described before, which is really the affidavit is just a statement that the condition has been triggered in the order affording the original moving party to relief. So in any event, the objection was then treated as something that would give rise to a hearing, and the objections, are a wide range of things. They are seldom an objection. Well, they are sometimes, but not that frequently, an objection that says the affidavit is just wrong. And in that sense, one can sort of understand it as being an objection, because the objection is, they say the condition is satisfied, but the condition is not actually satisfied. But oftentimes the objection is along the lines of, I didn't comply with the order, the doomsday order, but either I had a good reason not to comply with it, I needed more time for some reason, or I didn't comply with it, but I can comply with it. I've cured the default, or I promise to cure the default in the future. Give me another chance. So here is kind of where things really broke down, where there's dissimilarity. First, I think there's some dissimilarity on how long the court waited to act on the affidavit of default, that is to say, to do an order that says that the party is entitled to the relief under the doomsday order. And second, some of us automatically set a hearing on all of those affidavits or objections to affidavits of default, and some of us, at least me, basically treated in many instances the objection to the affidavit as a request for relief from the doomsday order, or in essence something akin to a motion to strike or a motion to disregard the affidavit. And the and then treated that as a motion to which the other side needed to respond, at least if I thought that there was grounds to call for a response, and set a hearing then only thereafter. So we've sort of talked upon amongst ourselves and tried to come up with a uniform set of procedures, and that's what we're here to undertake, sort of describe to you what the proposal is. And the benefit that we hope to move to sort of an approach that if one wants relief from a doomsday order, one needs to seek that relief by filing a request for relief, which is to say a motion. Optimally, one would get the relief ahead of time by working with the party who's sort of the trustee or the secured creditor who has the benefit of the doomsday provision. But the idea is basically to make this part of the practice kind of like everything else, where there's sort of the ability to work things out in advance, where there's the ability to sort of solve things by negative notice, which is to say if no one objects to whatever the relief is and there's, you know, a conceivably plausible reason for it, then the relief would go forward without the sort of court having to have a hearing on every single one of these. So that's the overview, and I'll turn it. So what we're going to do then is Judge Ludwig is going to describe the procedure, and Judge Perhatch is going to sort of walk through it in a sort of more, there's some slides in here, sort of a flow chart type approach, which I think will be useful not only for some of you as sort of a different way to understand it, but also maybe as a teaching guide to others who aren't here. And Judge Hand's going to pipe in with observations along the way, and I'm going to try to remain silent. So with that, Judge Ludwig.
As Mike said, we're hoping to achieve some consistency in our processes, which we have an interest in doing, and I assume that you all have an interest in us doing. So the proposal going forward is this. So doomsday order gets entered, and, you know, the common situations where that occurs, it's a motion for relief from stay, right? So the debtor has failed to make mortgage payments, motion for relief from stay gets filed. Oftentimes, the parties simply agree, or you show up on our Thursday calendars and say we've reached an agreement, and then a proposed order gets entered, which includes, you know, 6-month doomsday on plan or on mortgage payments going forward, right to renew by letter, blah blah blah.
So this is the East, so it's on Tuesday.
Tuesday, yes. I'm sorry.
So much for remaining silent. Go ahead.
That's one. All right. So the other common example is obviously the trustee's motion to dismiss. Failure to make plan payments, and again, those are commonly resolved by stipulation with the trustee's office, and often include a doomsday on plan payments going forward for 6 months, whatever. So the gist of the doomsday order, as Mike alluded to earlier, is that it's really there's been a preceding motion or and that has been resolved, and the resolution is an order from the court that says if X happens, if there's X default under these conditions, Y will occur. Relief from stay will be entered. The case will be dismissed. So there's no further adjudication really needed. It's we've had one motion filed. This if now there are conditions going forward under the court order, and if those conditions aren't followed, there's going to be a remedy. So that order gets entered like any other court order. It can be modified. So if the debtor has a problem, can't make the mortgage payments, can't make the plan payments, there's an order out there requiring them to do it. It's no longer just a provision of the code requiring it. There's actually a court order saying you need to do this, and if you don't, your case is going to get dismissed or relief from stay is going to get granted. So what do you do? Well, the first thing to do is meet and confer, is you talk to the other side. Talk to the trustee, talk to the creditor, and say, my client's not going to be able to do this. We need to change the order. Enter into a stipulation. Under our new protocol, obviously, stipulation, people agree to change these things. We're generally 99.999% of the time are going to enter a modified order and change the doomsday. Sometimes you can negotiate something that extends the doomsday, right? We do that all the time. So what we really want parties to do is to start meeting and conferring to resolve these things. If the meet and confer, there's no consensual resolution, the next thing is, again, this is all pre-default, file a motion to amend. We've got an order out there that requires my client to do X. I move to extend the time to make my October payment to November 1st instead of October 1st. Under Bankruptcy Rule 9006B for enlarging time, if that motion is made before the deadline is passed, you simply need to establish cause. It's a very, very easy standard to meet, and I think we generally grant those with very little discussion. But it's a motion. So that's all pre-default, and I realize that in the real world, recognizing that that's going to happen before the default happens is sometimes a challenge, especially if your clients aren't real communicative. So if that doesn't happen, and then the other party, usually the creditor or the trustee, files an affidavit of default or a certification of default or a declaration of default, whatever it is, that gets filed and served. And then we're proposing to adopt a seven-day holding period uniformly. That gets filed. All of the judges will wait 7 days to give the party who's being subject to that relief the opportunity to negotiate the withdrawal of the affidavit of default. Again, meet and confer. That gets filed. The first thing you do is call the trustee or call the creditor and say, can we get relief from this? We need more time an opportunity to negotiate. Alternatively, as Mike said, sometimes if there's no agreement, you file a motion to, again, amend you're subject to a court order. Even if the affidavit's been filed, you can move to amend the order. Really, it's those two things. If you negotiate for the withdrawal and the trustee or the creditor agrees to withdraw the evidence of default, we're not going to take any action, and that's good. Okay, the affidavit of default's been withdrawn. We're fine. We won't take any further action. If that doesn't happen, you've got 7 days to file a motion, and that motion can be a motion to strike, as Mike said. If the affidavit of default says the debtor didn't make the October payment, we're entitled to dismiss the case or relief from stay. Could be that the debtor made the October payment and you file a motion to strike. That affidavit, that certification is false. It's wrong. That motion should be supported by facts sufficient to show that you're entitled to relief. And it'll be served with a seven-day period for objections. And again, it's getting back to sort of our typical negative notice. If that motion gets filed and there's no objection from the trustee or the creditor within 7 days, typically we would strike it and the relief would not be granted.
Grant the motion,
but right. not enter the relief required under the doomsday order.
Right.
Same way with if it's to extend time to make planned payments, file your motion if you can't get agreement. Now, one of the trickier things with trying to change the deadline after you've blown the deadline, under Rule 9006B, if you make that motion after the deadline has expired, it's no longer just cause. You have to show excusable neglect. It's a higher standard. I'd encourage folks to read. Seventh Circuit has a decision, In Re Canopy Financial, 708 F3rd 934. It's a 2013 decision by Judge Easterbrook, where he sort of goes through what you need to show to, it's a bankruptcy case, and to what you need to show to establish excusable neglect. And the point of that case is, when you're going to establish excusable neglect, you have to give the court evidence, facts, on which the court can conclude there was a there is a basis here to find that there was a violation, but it's excusable. So those are sort of the ways to avoid relief after the affidavit of default is filed. Either get the either negotiate the withdrawal or to file a motion, either disputing the default or indicating that you're trying to change the time period afterwards. There's also a situation that sometimes arises where, for example, with the trustee, where it's not just make plan payments, it's file tax returns. And it may be that after that, and that's subject to a doomsday, and it may be that after that's entered, you realize the circumstances have changed, the debtor didn't have enough income, so the tax returns weren't required. Okay. The order says you have to provide copies of those tax returns. Now you realize you can't because there aren't any tax returns. There never will be any tax returns. But you file a motion to amend the order to excuse that and explain that. It'll be subject to a 7-day objection period. Again, negative notice if the trustee doesn't object. We will grant the motion and not enter the relief under the doomsday order. That's sort of the, in a nutshell, what it is we're trying to do and sort of procedurally how we're going to do it. I think Katie can now sort of walk through her more detailed.
So let me add one thing before we move to that. Yeah, I know that's number two. So one thing that Judge Ludwig has mentioned, and I think maybe I mentioned at a very high level, but is worth, I think, drawing more emphasis to, is that historically, going back, certainly to the before the trustees that we have now, it's my impression was that trustee withdrawal of an affidavit of default was something that was not going to happen voluntarily, and I never quite understood that, because if we focus on motions to dismiss, you know really the Chapter 13 trustees are a lot closer to all of the facts involved in any particular case than we are. And it's always seemed to me better that they're in a better position to make a judgment call about, does it make sense to, okay, this person's now cured or said they can cure, does it make sense to hold off on enforcing this doomsday order or maybe just negotiating an extension of the doomsday period rather than pulling the plug on the case now and enforcing the doomsday order. But there'd be an objection, and then it would be dropped into the judge's lap, and the judges would be the ones end up trying to get a feel for how much does a trustee really care about this, and what are the facts, and is this a case that should end now, or is this a case that should be allowed to continue? And I think then you get a lot of dissimilarity because the judges are going to have sort of a different appetite for that. I think we collectively think it makes a lot more sense to have the sort of people closer to the cases in the first instance to see if they can work that out and make a judgment call about that. And I think for good or for bad, I think the trustees have sort of felt constrained that once there's this doomsday order and there's a default, they have to let the court know, and then it's like to the court to sort that out. That paradigm, I think I can speak for everybody, isn't to us the best one. And so part of this effort is to allow greater ability or to hope that there will be greater ability and discussion among, debtors' counsel and the trustees, especially, and creditors' counsels, to try to see if there isn't some way to work this out, which, ultimately, if there's not, and, if the debtor thinks, I've got a good excuse for this and I got a good reason to need more time, and the trustee says, no, I think this case should end, then, yeah, we're here to work that out. That's what y'all pay us to do. But, in terms of, who knows the most about the circumstances, it's y'all. And so if you guys could figure that out, we would like to have you build a process that allows an opportunity to do that. So,
and it's safe to say that some of it, at least pre-default, isn't happening already. I mean, we certainly see evidence of that. But one, for the consistency in approach, and two, I think, just to promote more of it.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry.
So I put together some slides because I read through the presentation that Judge Ludwig had put together, and I thought, okay, well, it would be helpful to have a visual representation of what we're talking about, right? And I also thought that you guys are going to have to go back and perhaps show associates or show paralegals or show staff members as to what it was that we were thinking about and what we're thinking of what that chronology looks like. I have no hope at all that I have covered everything in these flowcharts. I'm sure that there are scenarios that you can all come up with that are completely out there and that I haven't thought of in this flowchart. But this is a general idea of what we're thinking about. And so on the first slide, you'll see before a default happens. And so this is the debtor is going to miss a deadline set forth in a doomsday order to make a payment, file a document, file an amendment. And there's two options, right? You can file a notice of motion and motion to enlarge time under 9006B, which is what Judge Ludwig alluded to. You have to show cause, right? It's a different standard because it's before the default. And you've got to state specific facts under 9013. Objections to that motion are due in 7 days. If there's not an objection, we're likely going to enter an order enlarging the time, right? If there is an objection, we might set it for a preliminary hearing. We might set it for an evidentiary hearing if we think we need evidence on cause. If you don't state specific facts in your motion under 9013, we may just deny it because we don't have a basis to show cause under 9006B. Or you can do a stipulated request to extend the deadlines in the doomsday order and submit an agreed order, and then we're going to enter an order approving that stipulation. That's before the default happens, and that's what this chart is trying to get at. So on the second chart that we put together, this is after the default happened, and I think we all realize that you guys are dealing with challenging clients, right? And, like, you are not hearing from them before the default happens. You're hearing from them after the default happens. Yeah. So we get that, right? And so this chart goes to the first part of the written stuff where we're talking about disputing the default. And so there's disputing the default and there's amending the doomsday order. So if you want to dispute the default in that there isn't a default, the creditor didn't get my payments, the creditor's lying, this affidavit of default is untrue, I sent all of this stuff. You can call the trustee's office and say, hey, here's the information that I have. I think that this payment actually came into you. Here's the proof of that. And maybe the trustee's just going to withdraw the affidavit of default. I think we also recognize the fact that we're holding those affidavits of default for 7 days, right? You guys may need additional time than those 7 days to negotiate something. We are more than willing to hold for a brief period of time longer than that 7-day holding period, probably an additional 7 to 14 days. Or if you guys file something saying we need more time than that, we just want to know why you need more time than that. So we could do that. We can extend that holding period if you guys are negotiating some type of a deal.
And that probably, I mean, I guess we haven't really drilled down. And that could be a letter, right, that says, you know, I've talked to the trustee, and the trustee and I agree that we need another 7 days or whatever.
And when I looked at this flow chart last night, I see that it says an order granting the request for extension. I don't think that we need to enter orders on all of these. I don't think you guys need to submit orders on all of these.
We might do a docket notice or something.
Details
we haven't quite worked out yet. But
I'm not sure that we need an order. Or it may just be that we're going to set a doc tracker in CM that says we're going to hold these for another 7 days because we got your request, right, and we're not going to enter an order. So again, after the default, disputing the default. So let's say you cannot strike a deal with the trustee. You cannot strike a deal with the creditor. Then it's a notice of motion and motion to strike, along with a proposed order, right? Saying, we think this is untrue because, and we want specific information about what the because is. The trustee and the creditor then have an opportunity to file an objection to that motion to strike. And then the options are back, right? There can be a withdrawal of the affidavit of default. There can be a stipulated request and proposed order to amend the doomsday. There can be an objection to that motion that gets filed. There's the objection and then the response. And then the court can take no action because you guys withdraw it.
No, there's a motion to strike and then there's an objection.
Yeah, the motion to strike and then the objection. Sorry, I got lost in my
flowchart.
Yeah, I know,
right.
No problem. Again, there can be that withdrawal. There can be a stipulation. If it doesn't state enough information, we may just deny the motion to strike. If there's no objection, we may just enter an order granting the motion to strike. And if there is an objection, we may just set that right for an evidentiary hearing because we may need evidence as to whether or not there's been a default under the doomsday order or not a default under the doomsday order. That's if you're disputing it, and there's you're going back and forth on that. So then the next slide is, again, after the default. This is, I want to amend the doomsday order. You know, the default shouldn't result in the granting of the affidavit of default. You know, things happen, right? Your clients can't make the payments. Maybe there's a reason for that. So, again, the two options are contact the party who's filed the affidavit of default to see if there's a deal that can be struck, if there's an amended order that can be submitted, or if the affidavit of default can be withdrawn. Or you can file that notice of motion and motion to enlarge time in a proposed order under 9006B. But as Judge Ludwig alluded to, that requires a showing of excusable neglect. Again, objections to that motion are due within 7 days. If there's no objection, we likely are going to file or sign an order granting that motion to enlarge time. If you don't state specific facts in support of that motion, you may see an order denying that motion from us if we don't have cause to, or if we don't see excusable neglect in the paperwork that you filed. Or if there's an objection filed, we may set it for an evidentiary hearing or a preliminary hearing to hear more about what the excusable neglect grounds are for amending that doomsday order. On the next slide, this one is just the... We do see circumstances where the affidavit of default is filed, we hold it for 7 days, and then the court signs an order dismissing the case. It's a different rule if you want to get that order vacated, and it's 9024 Rule 60B. Again, that requires a showing of excusable neglect because we've already entered that order. And then I think Judge Helfinger's favorite slide is the last one, where if you comply with the doomsday order, there's no need for any of these other flowcharts.
Anything to add?
No.
Yeah, so.
Yes.
Yes. So, just to your point about that, the withdrawal of the affidavits of default, I think my office has been a lot more amenable to that than my predecessor was. I understand what her reticence to withdraw those were. My policy generally is that if the default has been cured, my office is willing to stipulate to having the affidavit withdrawn as long as it's acknowledged that we didn't file it incorrectly. And I think that's really where my predecessor was concerned about it. She didn't want the perception to be that the affidavits were being filed incorrectly or whatnot. So that's been my office's procedure since I took over, and I think we do withdraw a number of those where I think that perhaps sometimes we end up going to hearing on those, is where the affidavit hasn't been cured and the indication is, well, we're intending to cure it someday in the future, or we cured the affidavit, but now another month has passed and they haven't, while it wasn't really the basis of the affidavit, for example, the affidavit was filed after missing the July payment. We cure the July payment, but now the August payment has come due and they haven't made that one. So the affidavit technically has been cured, but the debtor is still in default under the order, and so we don't want to withdraw the one default and just have to file another one. And so sometimes that's where that situation comes up. And I can see under this procedure maybe opportunities to file a stipulation to extend the default and over the doomsday period, et cetera, and resolve things that way. I think that's certainly a good procedure for us to be able to utilize. What I'm concerned about is, twofold. One, on a motion to strike an affidavit of default. So on page two, they have to provide specific facts to support the motion. then whether or not that motion to strike is simply going to be, I understand if you find it an error somehow that you know, there may be grounds to strike at that point, but are the judges going to consider valid grounds to strike an affidavit where it's just, well, we have cured it, is that grounds to strike? And do we have to object if they say, well, we're going to cure it in 3 weeks, and we like the affidavit stricken, because the trustee's not agreeing to stipulate, and we like it stricken, we're going to cure the default 3 weeks from now. You know, do I have to file now? Do I have to get my staff attorneys or my paralegal to draft an objection to that, saying, well, that's not really grounds to strike the affidavit, or will the court just say, that's not good grounds, no response is necessary? I don't know. And so I think that's kind of one aspect I'm a little worried about, is having to draft a lot of objections and motions to strike that may not really have grounds to strike.
Right. So speaking only for myself, so I don't know how well people can hear Scott in the back of the room. There was a lot going on in what he said. But the last thing, which is the thing I'm going to focus on right now, is if the trustee files an affidavit, someone files a motion to strike the affidavit, the grounds for the motion to strike are, well, I'm going to cure this. I'm either cured it now or I'm going to cure it in the future. Those are not grounds for a motion to strike. The only grounds for a motion to strike an affidavit are that the affidavit is wrong. That's the only grounds for a motion to strike an affidavit. So if it came to my attention before the response period that was the grounds for the motion to strike, I would just deny the motion. Now, given, you know, the ordinary course of things, I might not realize that, because his second point was, well, do I need to respond to that if it's not proper grounds? Not if I notice it, but it might not be brought to my attention, right? But I think the response to that is just, this isn't proper grounds for a motion to strike. It ought to be denied. I don't know that yes, you need to file something, but I don't know that it needs to say anything more than that if that's all that's going on. So let me address a couple of other things Scott said before he got to that. I certainly appreciate that there's a lot more, like, movement. That my sense is, and, you know, being on this side, it's very hard. One only has a sense. My sense is that there's a lot more movement and ability of the trustees and undertaking of the trustees to sort of resolve these things than there was, say, when I started 6 years ago. So I was really trying to describe the historical practice, and quite frankly, by making that point about, you know, we hope there would be more of that, right? He also made a point about that his predecessor didn't want to just withdraw the affidavit default and sort of have the suggestion that meant the affidavit was wrong. Speaking for me, and I suspect my colleagues, you know, like, I was a litigator, right? Somebody would withdraw things. There's all kinds of reasons somebody might withdraw things. I would never take the withdrawn affidavit to infer in any way that the affidavit was wrong. Maybe it was wrong, or maybe they just worked out a deal to do something else. And especially if it was withdrawn with, you know, an extension of the doomsday or even without that, I would never infer that. I would just infer that for whatever reason, the trustee who has the discretion to do this under the terms of the order, it's their right either to file this thing or not, or the creditor. If they withdraw it, quite frankly, I don't care, and I wouldn't infer anything from that. So with what time we have left, which is about 24 minutes, the reason for the round tables, not just to make it more hard for everybody to see, is that we wanted to, the judges are sort of, we want to have sort of a discussion of this, and, you know, trying to do a discussion with classroom style or whatever and having us up here and you guys all back there. You know, I applaud Scott's asking that question to get some discussion going, but it's not the best way to have discussion. So we're going to try to spread out the room. There's some other, I think some of the clerks are here, and they can spread out in the room. And, you know, we kind of want to know, do people foresee problems or whatever other issues you see that we ought to address? Because as you can tell from this discussion, there are some, you know, it's not like this has all been worked out down to every little thing. And so that's what we'll do at the rest of it, and then we'll come and we'll wrap up a couple minutes before the hour. Okay, thank you. Great job.
all good.
You're the only one that didn't hear code. Beth even has her code. Take his quick.
I didn't memorize that.
I was going to say, he probably has like some catch or something like
that. Right.
Some things that, you know, quite frankly, we just blew it when we did the last rules revision, when we tried to do everything at once, that we need to make some relatively modest corrections. The trustees in the court are also looking at some, I guess I will call them, tweaks to the model plan form, so that's forthcoming. So I might, you know, everyone who wants to participate in the liaison committee ought to participate, and I think what we'll try to do is do some quarterly meetings that were somewhat like the rules meetings, because in part I thought the biggest sort of benefit of the rules meetings was the opportunity to sit down with the lawyers from the various parts of the practice and to sort of learn from them and what things they're dealing with in a way that, you know, you can't do when you're sitting at the bench. It just doesn't provide for that. And so we're hopeful to breathe some new life into that. That's the first thing. The second thing is, like affidavit of default, if there's other areas that you think we are, you know, sort of not, that there's dissimilarity in the procedures that the judges use, you know, really, you know, let us know somehow, whether or not, you know, it's by letting us know directly, by letting one of the staff people know, whether or not, you know, it's sending an email to Sean in the clerk's office, Mike Maloney's the liaison for the biker board. You could let him know, and I'm pretty confident that he won't shy away from letting us know. Or you could let us know directly. You could come to one of these liaison meetings, committee meetings, but let us know somewhere, because, you know, we may just not realize that we're doing things differently. I mean, we do have regular judges meetings, and we try to talk about things, but it completely wouldn't surprise me if there's some things that we do differently and we just don't realize it, and maybe we ought to, I mean, maybe that's making it more difficult for you. And, you know, maybe if we knew, we might decide to do it more similarly. I don't promise that. Maybe we wouldn't. But it'd be better if we knew. So I know that sometimes that kind of plea falls on deaf ears, but it really would be helpful. So unless anybody has anything else,
The Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah. October 29th at noon. There's going to be a meeting like this one in this room?
Yeah. Yes.
In this room, I hear yeses. Tom Schreiner and Pete Plain are going to present on the Supreme Court's past term, the 2018 term, and what is being going forward in the 2019 term. Mr. Keepman, you had your hand up. Mike?
No.
You withdrew the motion. Okay. All right. Thank you all for coming. It's great to see all of you here, and appreciate you coming out on a Friday afternoon.
Thanks.